My name is Rick Bradshaw. I was just introduced. And today we're going to talk about clouds, eucalyptus, all kinds of stuff. This is just a nice overview of what we're going to discuss. I'm going to give a little introduction about who we are, what we were doing, why we were doing it, a little bit of background, and then we're going to dive right in, and we're going to start talking about some experiences with eucalyptus. We're going to cover some scalability, good and bad, some security issues. Peter is quite the security professional. And then we're going to talk about how we support the machine, and then we'll talk about a little bit of future work. Can I do that? Where am I at? There. Is that what I do? Yeah. Okay. So, the reason why we started all this back at the beginning of the year, back in January, was that we both are involved with a project called the Magellan Project. It's a DOE project to investigate medium-sized HPC for DOE. Part of that is to determine if clouds are worth deploying for HPC workloads. Now, to I'm sure most people have heard about clouds. It's quite the buzzword. So we're going to discuss a little bit about the different types of APIs out there. I'm sure most people are very familiar with Amazon. They seem to have led this whole cloud regime. And then there's new players that have come along, Rackspace, Nimbus. There's probably tens, 20s, hundreds more. Who knows? But there's a large influx of new software coming out to provide cloud functionality for people. So why did we choose eucalyptus? At the time, it was pretty much the only game in town. There might have been others, but they were very immature at the time. It had a nice wide range of EC2 compatibility, both in S3 or EBS, and also with the normal just cloud workload. It was open source. They have a pay-for product. We chose not to use that due to certain higher-level political type issues. And finally, we used UEC, which is the Ubuntu Enterprise Cloud Edition of Ubuntu. And as previous Ubuntu users, it seemed like a logical choice. Plus, they were willing to do patches and scripts on top of the normal eucalyptus distribution to make sure that it integrated well with the OS. So most of our work was all done with eucalyptus 1.6.2. There is a newer version out now. I actually believe there's an even newer version. They released 2.0 a while ago, and I believe they just announced that 2.0.1 is now available. But most of what we're going to talk about here is our experience with 1.6.2. And basically, this is a quick architecture diagram. I'm just going to let this transition. But the idea is that it's a fairly distributed piece of software. And then I'm going to hand this over to Peter to talk about more specifics.
Hey, everybody. I'm Peter Spiegel. I got to give you like the 20-second explanation of eucalyptus architecture so that the next couple slides make sense. So what you're looking at is up at the top are all the client systems and applications. That's where you'd be sitting at your desktop running commands. All that stuff goes basically through the cloud controller that is eucalyptus's web front end. It provides all the web services. The cloud controller then can communicate with Walrus is up there. Walrus is actually their storage controller. It's kind of the counterpart to the cloud controller. And then behind that, you've got a cluster controller and the storage controller. Those both then are kind of the back end of eucalyptus. And then at the bottom here in these boxes, you've got node controllers. What these guys do is actually run all the virtual machines. So when you ask for a virtual machine, they get executed and run on these node controllers. So the cluster controllers manage all of those nodes behind them. You have to basically register whatever working machines you have with a cluster controller so that you can then serve out virtual machines and resources. So we just copied the, just in case you didn't get enough of that great graphic, we put it up there at the top of here, because I'm going to talk about scalability. So back when we set this eucalyptus up, you know, we needed to test various scalability around it. We have quite a decent size cluster of 500 nodes running for the Magellan project, and so we wanted to see, you know, where, you know, how big can we make this eucalyptus thing. We tested various size clusters, so that would be the number of node controllers behind a single cluster controller. So we tested at about 40 nodes, 80, 160, and 240 roughly, and at each of those levels kind of compared performance, did various operations and tests around it. All around, I have to say performance was best at the smaller sizes. I would say at the 40 and the 80, you know, was acceptable. Once you start pushing the size of a single, the number of nodes behind one single cluster controller, you start seeing deterioration. A lot of the operations that Eucalyptus is doing, they're iterative and they're serial. And so as the cluster grows and it needs to communicate with, you know, 100 or 200 machines, it now slows, it kind of bogs down doing certain things. I wanted to highlight one specific one, which I absolutely loved. It was the termination operation. So anyone familiar with the Amazon or the Yuka tools, there's a command, Yuka terminate instance, right? You start up a VM, you want to kill it, you run this command. And generally, you know, it sends a message. The cluster controller up there knows where this virtual machine is. So it generally sends a message to that node controller to shut down the machine, and then it waits a you know, certain amount of time. And if it doesn't hear back, here's where it gets fun. So sometimes shutting down these virtual machines takes a little while. We have some of our images are sized for 100 gig of virtual disk. Well, it has to like kind of break that down and return the resources to the underlying OS before it releases and officially calls the VM shut down. Well, you know, that takes some time, and Eucalyptus then decides, well, something's wrong, you know, I haven't heard back, it's not shut down, and it just starts to serially like blast out termination requests to every node controller. So, you know, if I have one virtual machine to shut down and I have 200 nodes, it sends 200 requests. If I shut down 50 of them, things start to get really fun, because it sits there and it will shoot 50 requests one by one to every single node controller via TCP connections. It's really slow and horrid. and the worst part of it is we had situations where virtual machines didn't start. And by looking at debug information, you can see that they basically died at the cloud controller or at the cluster controller. They tried to do a run instance, something happened, you know, couldn't allocate an address, whatever it was, and it failed. And when it came around to terminate it, because eventually it's got to kind of clean out things, so it tries to terminate them, and they never made it to the node controller. They never got out here. There was no request to do anything. And yet the cluster controller will sit there and it'll still do this rapid fire Gatling gun, you know, shutdown operation, which is just horrid. Why something that failed, why it didn't note that to itself, I don't know. But that really hurt performance on some of the larger clusters. Aside from looking at cluster sizes, we also looked at load testing. So we basically set up a given size cluster, and then we tried just starting as many simultaneous virtual machines as we could. In this case, we didn't really have the machines doing anything. We just wanted to see them start up and just be in the running state and see how much Eucalyptus could handle. And what we found, so Eucalyptus, given enough time, it performs acceptably. You know, if you request, you know, just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of VMs, like, up front, it might choke on that. If you give it a little time, if you ask for 100 now and you wait, you know, 30 minutes and you ask for more, you know, it can handle that. What it really hated was what I call rapid churning. So we learned this early on, and we also have a colleague at Argonne who, that's kind of what he's doing for his research. He's basically looking at startup and shutdown of virtual machines and clouds. And eucalyptus really dislikes if you start like 50 machines and then immediately kill them and then start 50 more and kill them. It gets into a really bad state, a lot of heartburn. Also ran into a hard limit. So the code built into it seems to have a limit somewhere between 750 and 800 running virtual machines. The cloud controller will stop servicing requests. It will just freeze, literally, because what's happening is it's on the back end is it's trying to communicate with the cluster controller, and it sends a description of all the running virtual machines. And with 750 to 800, you've exceeded the message size that they have defined in the source code. So once you exceed that, it can no longer, since the message is too big, it can't send it, and the cloud can no longer give you more virtual machines. It still functions, like you can do a termination, for instance. So we were able to terminate like 50 machines, and then as soon as you get under like 750, it starts working again. As soon as it can start sending that message, it'll start working again. But it was really, really kind of strange, and it was basically in the code. There were debug messages about this communication being too big. I want to jump into security. Security was being a security person, this was a huge area of concern for me. Right there on the bottom, again, I got to give you like the 20-second like description. So eucalyptus has many ways to do networking for the virtual machines. There's two that are called managed and managed no VLAN. And what managed is basically the cluster controller manages the network slices that are being handed out to the virtual machines. What that means is there's bridging going on the diagram there, that little machine that's sitting off to the right between those two switches, it is the representation of the cluster controller, and all of the traffic is traveling through that machine, so it kind of pulls all that traffic in, and then it allows you to do security groups, for instance. So if anyone's familiar with Amazon's security groups, that is how it does it. It basically does IP tables on the cluster controller for the various virtual machines that are running on it. And so, we chose to run in managed no VLAN. You can run it with where it also does VLANs for you, but we didn't do that on ours. A couple nice things it does for you is VM network traffic that virtual machines that don't have external IPs, they get to masquerade as the cluster controller on the internet. So when they try to leave, it's nice to them and gives them an address that they can use to recover patches, pull down patches or do whatever they need to do. From a security perspective, that's not that great, because if I detect bad traffic leaving the cloud, I can't tell who did it. on top of that, through testing, we were able to figure out that by default, the virtual machines can talk to the internal networks. You can't really see the internal network, that like the physical network that you're running on, but if you were to, if you scan around, you kind of grope around in the dark, you can find IP space being used by kind of the support systems, the management systems, the other backend systems, the node controllers that it's running on, that other virtual machines are running on. And generally speaking, this is bad. We're treating virtual machines as kind of alien images that we don't want talking to our internal network. So what we actually figured out is you can put some IP tables rules on the node controllers themselves, so all the way on the machines where the virtual machines are running. And at that point, you know who's generating traffic, and you can stop it right there and say, look, a virtual machine IP should never, never be talking to network X and network Y. And so that's basically what we put in place, and that ensures that traffic leaving the virtual machines, the only place it can go is out to the internet, and can't really hang around our internal network. Another area, so I'm a security guy. IDSs are not dead. maybe soon, but for right now, they're not. So I was looking to put an IDS in place, and I was thinking about, you know, where can we put this? And, you know, kind of the risk areas that I was interested in was, okay, I want to see when outside IPs are attacking our virtual machines. I want to see when virtual machines are scanning or attacking outside IPs, because certainly you could have a bad actor start up a virtual machine and start doing things out of our cloud, and guess who gets the call? And then finally, another area of concern was VMs running what I call suspect services. I hesitate to call them like banned services and things like that. I mean, because it might be a web server or an FTP server, and it's not that we don't want them, you know, our users to do that, but we want to ensure that the stuff they're serving up is not, you know, is not pirated software or stuff like that. So it was more of a, it wasn't to detect and shut down, it was to detect and kind of identify what the actual service was doing, and just be aware of what's happening out on the cloud, because that's a very difficult thing to figure out what is actually going on this, you know, huge space inside the system. And so in this case, Managed No VLAN totally buys us an awesome place to plug in the IDS. So because all the traffic's being aggregated at the cluster controller, the inside interface of that cluster controller is a perfect place to mirror traffic. And so that's exactly what we did. Plugged in an IDS, mirrored the traffic off the inside of the cluster controller, and you get to see all inbound and outbound traffic going to the VMs. So off to the internet, you know, between the VMs and the internet. You get to see VMs talking between security groups. So this is every time you instantiate a security group or anyone else does, you get a slice of network. And that slice of network has a broadcast address and a default route on the cluster controller. And so traffic actually has to pass through the cluster controller to get to another one. That being said, so that causes the traffic to be visible then to the IDS. One place we couldn't see was communication within a security group. So if you start up two VMs and you tell them to talk to each other, I can't see that. Not that big a deal. If you're attacking yourself, well, it's not my concern. And so we had some success then being able to write customized, you know, rules and things to watch behavior of these virtual machines. One final, I think, area of concern for us was image security. So Eucalyptus gives you the ability to upload your own images to run in the virtualized environment, and you can customize them in any way, install whatever software. This, for research purposes, it's great. You know, you don't have to sit there and spin up a VM and wrestle with it every time to get your package installed. You can do it once, upload the image, spawn it 100 times. We had, you know, folks doing that, and with great success. So one key little distinction. So Eucalyptus allows you to upload customized disk images. However, kernels and RAM disks are reserved for sysadmins only. So you need, if you have a customized kernel you want, you actually have to contact the sysadmin and say, look, can you register this kernel for me? Generally, what we recommend the users to do is to take an existing image off of Eucalyptus. You can download them of the ones that we have installed, because we have them paired already with kernels, and then customize them to their needs. And that has also worked out well, because then they just run them with existing kernels. But there have been occasions where we've uploaded a customized kernel in there. Now, some of the security issues with this. So first of all, Eucalyptus uploads, when you upload an image, Eucalyptus automatically makes it public to everyone on the cluster. If you put a password in there for your database in a script on your VM, yes, your colleague can start it up and see that password, because by default, all your image is made public. And if you're not aware of this, there's actually commands you can run to change this. There's permissions to change. Being a security person, it should be the other way around, right? You know, it should upload. You should be the only one who can start it, and then you should grant permissions to other people. But that's not the way Eucalyptus has it set up. another concern, you know, I have, because I can see the scenario where somebody uploads a compromised image. It's already got the rootkit. It's got someone else's SSH keys and root. It's got, you know, you name it. There's a myriad of ways to do this, and you can make it very hard to detect. So On top of that, eucalyptus, when you upload an image, you have to put it in a bucket, and the bucket becomes the name of the image. A bucket is like a directory, basically. And eucalyptus is really open about naming conventions for the buckets. You can name it practically anything. And if I was trying to get people to run my image, I would look at the name of the current, you know, kind of default image on the system, and I would name my bucket very similar to that. So, you know, these are sorts of things where, you know, you might have to monitor the kind of activity going on and what people are uploading, but there's not, you know, besides going into the software to fix it, I mean, there's not a good way to do it. And in fact, we had an incident where it actually happened quite accidentally. Someone customized an image. They turned off the little bit that loads your SSH keys into place when you start up a virtual machine to allow you to connect to it, and instead they hard-coded in their own SSH keys. And then they told their colleague, hey, you can run my image. They weren't doing it maliciously. They were doing it, you know, to let their colleague play with it. And the colleague was having all these problems. They couldn't log in. And when it came down to it, that's exactly what they had done. They had basically locked down the image and didn't realize it. Finally, another area of concern. So users can upload images with exploitable vulnerabilities, vulnerable services, whatever you want to, you know, however you want to put it. Every user on Eucalyptus is a sysadmin. So, no matter what their skill level is, they're a sysadmin. They have to patch their systems. They have to configure them for security. They have to manage their security groups. They're given a lot of responsibility. I hate to say it, but not every, you know, scientist out there is a sysadmin. They're busy with their research. They don't have time to, you know, understand why RSH is a bad thing to open, you know, to the internet. So it's those sorts of things. We can, in this case, kind of the tactic we had to take is we can recommend best practices, but there's, you know, it's tough to require them. You know, we can only put pressure on them so much before we start stifling, you know, some of the research that's going on. So you kind of have to balance that with what's going on the system. So that about wraps it on security. I'm going to pass this back to Rick and let him wrap this thing
up. So the last thing to talk about is our user support model. That didn't really turn out too well. These are just some web front ends portals for users. But we chose to do a community-based support, mainly because the team that was put together to manage this really only consists of a single sysadmin and then a bunch of volunteers. So what we chose was to do user-facing wikis, user-based mailing lists, and forums, but unfortunately, we have still not decided on which form is the best to use, so we don't have one at all. And then the last thing that we do is best effort documentation. We ask any user that's going to use the system or that figures out anything about the system to document it, whether it be on the mailing list or in the wiki. We also have, you know, the systems or support team doing documentation. The final thing about user support, which Peter talked about a little bit, is there is a huge difference between supporting like an HPC workload or batch system users and a cloud user, mainly because they do have to support their own OS, which is sometimes a learning curve. The other thing is that we found was that pre-built images, a lot of times you can see, you know, oh, download this VM and you can run it wherever you want. Well, that isn't always the case. Mainly the biggest reasons why that doesn't work is that the kernels could be incompatible. For instance, as we mentioned, users can't upload their own kernels without the aid of sysadmins, and so they would either have to adapt that VM to use one of the predetermined kernels that we already offer, or they'd have to contact us and work with us to figure out if that kernel is usable. The other thing that happens quite a bit, as most people would probably fall into, is KVM versus Xen. A Zen-based image isn't going to run on KVM, and KVM isn't going to run on Zen. So there's work involved to convert an image back and forth. And then finally was the startup environment. The way that Eucalyptus in general does this VM startup is that it counts on processes inside the virtual machine itself to query the web service to get your SSH keys and install them. Well, if you don't have that script, guess what? Nobody gets SSH keys installed. So that's one more, you know, layer to cross to be able to just download something off the internet and run. Overall, though, we do have a working system. It is a cloud. There are users. Science gets done. But at the same time, we're still evaluating other solutions. We currently have a smaller Nimbus deployment that's slowly being tested or worked on. And we just started evaluating OpenStack, which is the combination of Rackspace and NASA, Nova software. And the last thing I would say is that you really shouldn't believe the hype. I will say that clouds can be useful, but you should really figure out what usage is going to be useful for your users. And also, is the API that you choose to use. A lot of people just default, like we did, to say EC2 is the, you know, the big giant in the room, so why not just fall for that? But at the same time, there's a lot of scientific users that will gladly use Nimbus, OpenNebula, any of these. It all depends on what you convince your users to use and what's going to best suit them. And that's about all I have for today. Argument over the microphone.
Hi, I got two questions for you.
Sure.
So in terms of system monitoring, are there any sort of best practices for Eucalyptus?
System monitoring? I would say that the only thing that I believe gets monitored is probably just the user-facing front-end services, WSDL and the S3. Do we do that?
Yeah.
I don't think we do any other kind of monitoring.
So I guess I'm referring more to CPU usage and memory usage.
Oh, no. Okay. We currently don't do any of that.
Are you aware if Eucalyptus expose any kind of its own specific metrics?
I am unaware of that.
Okay.
I would have to say that from my experiences, I haven't seen any of those, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. And they may even exist in the newer version.
Okay. And second question, when you first set up your Eucalyptus setup, mm-hmm. you obviously need to install OS from Bare Metal.
Right.
How do you set that up?
Oh, actually, that's a very good question, because I'd much rather talk about that software. That software that was written in-house by partly myself, but it's Bare Metal. It's called Changeling, and we also have a tool called Heckle that's a node manager. But basically, all it is it's an embedded Linux distro with a script that partitions the disk and rsyncs data onto the system.
Okay.
Very simple. Very simple. 60-line scripts and tiny core Linux.
And how well does it scale?
That's a really good question. The build system itself, the Bare Metal, would probably gladly scale as far as PXE or HTTP can scale.
Mm-hmm.
But the Heckle, or node management service, that does a lot of the node management, TFTP management, image management, we do certainly have scalability concerns there that I'm not going to talk about right now, but it isn't very scalable currently.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to make one last comment because you asked about how we built it. And what a lot of these cloud stacks tend to allow is the machines that actually run the virtual machines, so they're called computes or nodes or whatever, they're very cookie cutter. You can do a kickstart or some other automated install, and you drop the software on with a config file, and you're basically up and running. And those are the ones that by far, you're going to be deploying those in the hundreds or whatever, depending on the size of your cluster. And the kind of front-end machines, you need to customize those. But in order to drop, the software, it's very cookie-cutter. So, yeah, any kind of distributed, automated build process would work.
Cool. Go ahead.
Chris Reiser, DreamWorks Animation. You talked about the buckets with your image files. Where are those? Are those on the nodes themselves? Are they in NFS?
Those are actually stored in S3. Go ahead.
So I think I mentioned on that diagram those a thing called Walrus,
mm-hmm.
and the storage controller. So that's Eucalyptus's version of S3.
Oh.
And it's essentially that's where it gets stored. So there you basically create a bucket, a store, a place to store your files, and then start uploading into there. And it's an implementation, basically, of S3.
So how well does Eucalyptus handle when things go wrong? What happens if a node goes out and the VMs that are on it vanish? Can Eucalyptus recover from those kinds of events? Does it try to restore the VMs? And what happens when things go wrong?
It depends.
Right. The answer is it really does depend. Yeah. And in most cases... once you've lost like a node controller, the VMs that were on there are still known in the system. So you can still try and shut them down, but it's actually never going to happen. So
I'll have to disagree, because I think it eventually figures out they're gone and kind of cleans that out. So in your scenario, a node controller, and again, it's cookie cutter, it can totally blow up at any time and you can drop another one in, So in your scenario, yes, it can probably recover from that. I've seen it fail in many more fantastical ways that it can't recover from. Basically corruption of its in-memory databases, that it's tracking all this information. And once that starts going wrong, you basically have to kind of bounce the whole cloud system. We have never been able to bounce it and leave like running virtual machines out there. Like you come back and you lose some portion of the networking or something, and so it's much easier to just tell Eucalyptus to just shut everything down and bounce it. Now, again, as Rick mentioned, version 2.0 is out. Because we've been busy with OpenStack, we haven't really like played with it. So it may turn out that one's a lot more stable than 1.6.2 when we used it.
So it sounds like from your description that if from a customer-facing perspective, you have folks that, I'm just a Joe engineer at home and I brought up a VM in your cloud and I'm doing some work on it, and then the node went down, say a power failure, and it vanished. And then so it doesn't sound like it has any facilities to say, oh, this went down, so let me bring up your VM somewhere else so it can come back online. It just kind of goes away until somebody goes to fix it.
No, that would be way too fancy. That would be migration or something, and that would never happen.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Now, you're certainly free to write an app that monitors your VMs and brings up new ones when other ones go away. That would work.
Right, exactly. You could use the bot. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, so I was just wondering... are these VMs, are they temporary? And if they are, does a scientist need something for 2 weeks to do an experiment? Is there a scheduling mechanism built in where you could say start up 20 VMs on Monday and dismantle them on Friday when they don't need them?
Oh,
No, not really.
So there is the ability to provide a duration. No, there isn't. When you run instances, you run them, and they run until the machine crashes.
Or somebody purposely dismantles them, I guess.
Yeah, or you shut them down. Yeah, most of that, all of that functionality mainly comes from the EC2 API, so you could gladly write some Python code that would do what you want to do, because you can query the WSDL and all that to get the information and make decisions, but internal to Eucalyptus, no, there is nothing like that.
Yeah, and as Rick pointed out, I mean, depending on what you're trying to do, there's other cloud stacks out there that do support scheduling and do look more like a HPC type of, you know, submit your job and it will run eventually kind of deal. But Eucalyptus is very tied to the way Amazon does it, which is it's if you ask for it, you get it now, or you know, or maybe you get it later. But it's like if the resources are available, you get it. If they're not, you know, too bad. You know, get an error message back.
If you forget to shut down your VM, we'll still charge you.
Fair enough. Thanks.